Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
What if it's not a devil, but an angel in the details? What if the whole healthcare debate gets easier when we get more information and stop simplifying?
Tell me more. More and then some.
When they get into asking people about specific provisions, many polls show that people accept these provisions and want them and support them.
So give me all the dirty details, every little clause, every tax incentive, every factoid about pre-existing conditions.
I want some more and then some.
The more we know, the more we agree. Is it really that simple? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 24th. I'm joined by Todd Zwillick, who's with me for one more day. John Hockenberry returns tomorrow.
Thanks, Celeste. Let's get right to some of the top news stories we're following this morning, staying with the healthcare debate, where an idea that seemed toxic only a few weeks ago is gaining steam again with Democrats. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a parliamentary shortcut called reconciliation to bypass Republicans and pass a healthcare bill. Republicans are complaining because the move would allow Democrats to pass the bill with just 51 votes, but Reid says,
realistically, they should stop crying about reconciliation as if it's never been done before. It's done almost every Congress.
Reid says reconciliation has been used 21 times since 1981, mostly by Republicans.
But that's the tactics. What about the substance of the health care bill? We're joined now by Republican Congressman Michael Burgess, who serves the 26th District of Texas. That covers the Fort Worth area. He also practiced obstetrics and gynecology for 20 years, more than 20 years. Congressman, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Okay, so tell me, what is the number one thing that you think Congress can do to actually improve the health care system?
Well, the best thing we could do to improve the health care system would be get out of the way. But it doesn't look like we're going to do that. We have to find a way to make the purchaser of health care, the patient, actually put the power back in their hands. And nothing we are doing in any of the bills that are before us really moves us in that direction. In fact, if anything, we make the problem a little bit worse with greater expansion of administrative pricing and greater distancing between the patient, the physician, and and whoever's making the healthcare decisions.
Okay, Congressman Burgess, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Staying on Capitol Hill, Toyota President Akio Toyoda will address lawmakers later this morning. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist, who thinks Congress will go hard at Toyota's big boss.
They will appreciate that he's come all the way from Japan. However, this is a safety issue. It's an issue of populist politics as well.
Yesterday, Congress heard from the company's U.S. President, James Lentz.
We need to continue to be vigilant and continue to investigate all of the complaints that we get from consumers that we have done a relatively poor job of doing in the past.
Lentz said it's the faulty floor mats and gas pedals that are to blame for the sudden acceleration of vehicles. That's disputed by U.S. investigators.
In Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai is drawing fire for taking control of a formerly independent body that monitors election fraud. The group was previously run by the United Nations. And at the Olympics, the U.S. won a silver in the Nordic team relay yesterday. That means the U.S. now has a medal count of 26. In the markets, Asian markets are down. European indices mixed. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,292. The S&P opens at 1,094 and the NASDAQ at 2213. So our series Frustration Nation continues. We're going to be talking to two congressmen about the healthcare bill in just a moment. But we're asking you, we know you're frustrated. You've told us that many times. But what do you think? What's the solution? Some of our listeners have been giving some ideas on what to do. Stephen in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, post to our sites. Democrats must call the Republicans bluff. What's your take? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. More about the healthcare debate in just a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, and for one more day, I am joined by Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry until John returns tomorrow. Listening into this following conversation that we're going to have with two congressmen slash doctors are three folks from around the U.S. who are going to respond to what Congressman Burgess and McDermott have to say a little later in the hour. A televised bipartisan summit on healthcare is ready to take place in Washington tomorrow, Thursday. Analysts, observers, and indeed all of us are going to be watching to see if bipartisan is really a possibility anymore. President Obama had this message for Republicans in a speech in Nevada last week.
Show me what you got, but don't let the American people go another year, another 10 years, another 20 years without health insurance reform in this country.
We're here this morning with two U.S. lawmakers who are also healthcare professionals. They know what it's like to serve in the trenches of the U.S. healthcare system, and they're both aware that there are problems with the healthcare system and probably have ideas on how to fix it. Republican Congressman Michael Burgess, he serves the 26th District of Texas, including the Fort Worth area, and he practiced obstetrics and gynecology for more than 20 years. And Congressman Jim McDermott is a Democratic representative from Washington, also a trained psychiatrist and the longest-serving physician in Congress. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Congressman, we all of us know that the Americans are extremely frustrated with the arguments and what they see as gridlock going on in Washington right now. So I want to make a deal with both of you. Let's talk about the health care bill, not just the bill, but health care reform in a positive way today. I want to completely leave behind any statements about things that we might oppose in the bill. I know that there's things that everybody opposes, but let's not talk about this morning. We're going to make a deal that all we're going to talk about today are solutions that you support. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Both of you? Agreement?
Reserving the right to object.
take that right to object now, because we're going to move on with the conversation with solutions from here on out.
Okay, let's go to solutions.
Okay, let's start with you, Congressman Burgess. Let's go to rate hikes first, because we've been hearing a lot about Anthem Blue Cross in California, which in spite of record profits is raising its premium rates by 39%. People across the country are complaining about the skyrocketing costs of their insurance premiums. How do we fix it?
You know, this is interesting because we've got this, we actually have them coming into our oversight hearing today, and what is unclear to me from the documents that have been provided to me beforehand, California, where this occurred, actually has a prohibition against raising rates unless you can confirm that with actuarial data. What we're going to be missing from this hearing is the Commissioner of Insurance from California, who I guess is running for other political office. Did they approve that or not is really becomes the sentinel question. We already have a system to prevent that from happening. Do we need to create a new federal system? And if we do, why, and how could we make that better? I'm not convinced that's absolutely necessary, but at the same time, you're right, 40% is a scary number, and in some ways you wonder if this happened completely by accident, that this rate hike came in right on the eve of this summit.
Congressman Burgess from Texas with possible conspiracy theories. Jim McDermott out of Washington, what do you think about rate hikes? How do we fix them?
Well, the rate hike issue was set in place in Medicare, certainly, and that is the population in which most of the health care dollars are spent. When we decided that we would pay usual and customary fees and we would get away from any kind of regulation, it was a mistake made in 1965. And the only way really to get that is to get back to some kind of real regulation of rates, of costs of health care. And it's not easy to do. I've been doing this too long to think that you can have some magic answer here. But I do think that it is possible. Other countries, France, for instance, for half the money that we spend in the United States, uses regulation to control their health care costs. And it's possible to do, but you have to be vigorous. In this case, the Congress has been irregularly interested in doing this.
not often interested. Okay, you guys have probably seen the poll results out showing that when Americans are asked about specific provisions in much of the health care reform, they actually support them by large numbers, and I mean 60% to 70%, talking about health insurance exchange, getting rid of restrictions on pre-existing conditions, closing that donut hole in Medicare that makes seniors responsible for paying for their own drugs for a period of time. But they are confused about the entire bill and react negatively. So tell me, Congressman Burgess, let's start with you. Of the provisions that most Americans support, which do you also support?
There are about 7 or 9 things that we could all agree on and do.
Okay, give me 2 or 3 of them.
The first thing that when I heard from my constituents over the summer at the town hall, we don't like what you're doing, but would you please do something about pre-existing conditions? And in fact, we do have things that there are bills out there already written that would help with this. Again, for whatever reason, we've decided not to go there. The proposal, and here's the tough part too, because all these great things that the president is talking about doing is we're not going to get any of those till 2014, 2015 under the best of circumstances. But we could start tomorrow on just essentially insurance reform to begin to get around the problem of pre-existing conditions. You do that by risk pools. You do that by reinsurance. 34 states already have programs set up. Perhaps we're not funding them appropriately. Maybe that is one direction we could go. Congressional Budget Office said it would take about $25 billion over 10 years to do this. That number may be a little bit light, but
this is progress, Congressman Burgess. Congressman McDermott, you just heard your colleague say that at least on pre-existing conditions, when you guys meet in the summit tomorrow, you can find some consensus on that.
Well, actually, we'll have a chance to do it before tomorrow. On the floor of the House today, Mike and I'll have an opportunity to vote on the repeal of the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which gave monopolistic power to the insurance companies in the sense of not being available to be regulated by federal law. We've given that to the states all these years, and the mess has created, and now we have an opportunity to change that today. So we'll see by 9 o'clock tonight whether or not the Republicans really are serious about changing the law that protects insurance companies.
Well,
I'll
tell you
what. I hope they are.
We have 3 Americans listening right now that we're going to be talking to later to talk about whether or not we can find bipartisan support for some kind of health care reform. Congressman Michael Burgess is serving the 26th District of Texas that covers the Fort Worth area. And Congressman Jim McDermott is a Democrat from Washington, both physicians. It's 15 minutes after the hour. Let's check in now on the top stories.
At congressional hearings on safety issues with Toyota's vehicles yesterday, U.S. Executive James Lentz said the automaker will pay closer attention to customer complaints in the future.
We need to continue to be vigilant and continue to investigate all of the complaints that we get from consumers that we have done a relatively poor job of doing in the past.
We'll talk more about Toyota's problems and a possible conflict of interest for lawmakers looking into the issue. That's in just a few minutes. A report, meanwhile, by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says the president's economic stimulus package has created between 1 and 2 million jobs by the end of the year, or will have created them, rather. The figure has been contentious and, of course, highly political.
Now to the airports, where the first of 150 full-body scanners will be installed in Boston next week. The rest of the machines are expected to show up in the nation's airports by the end of June. Overseas, much of Greece has ground to a halt as up to 2 million workers hold a one-day general strike. They're protesting wide-ranging budget-cutting measures to deal with the country's ballooning debt. Finally, at the Olympics yesterday, the U.S. took a silver medal in the Nordic combined team relay. That's a ski jump followed by a cross-country race. And here's Todd Ludwig, one of the skiers from the winning U.S. team.
We've trained our hearts out. We've trained really, really hard about this. And yeah, it's my 5th games and in my first medal, and I couldn't be more proud of that medal in itself. But it's a team medal, and that's probably the coolest part about this medal.
The U.S. now has 26 medals in this Winter Games. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, more about the Toyota's president's appearance before Congress today and Miranda rights, changes to those.
You're listening to The Takeaway. from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the stories we're following this week. Money and politics. Toyota executives, of course, back on Capitol Hill today for questions about recalls. They're there all week. But money and politics, you have to follow the money on Capitol Hill. David Leventhal is communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics. He joins us now. His organization tracks lobbying money, congressional campaigns, and what law and where lawmakers get their money. Dave, is there a conflict of interest with Toyota from some of the lawmakers that are going to be questioning Toyota executives today?
There's certainly a very large intersection between Toyota and the federal government, and there are some lawmakers who, for example, have had stock holdings in Toyota. And one of them, Jane Harman, a representative from California, actually recused herself just last night, saying that she's not going to take part in the debate because, at least in 2008, the most recent records we have, she had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of Toyota stock.
Now, this is why we have disclosure. So I suppose it would be one thing if these were private, but what about Toyota's lobbying? How much do they spend in support of members?
Toyota is actually the largest lobbyer among all foreign automakers, bigger than Honda, bigger than Volkswagen, and only General Motors and Ford has actually lobbied the federal government to a greater degree over the past 5 years. In all, Toyota has spent about $25 million on federal lobbying efforts. That's in addition to money that its employees associated with Toyota have given directly to candidates in the form of campaign contributions.
Clearly something to keep in mind as we're watching the hearings today, lawmakers with personal interest in Toyota and also Toyota with an interest in lawmakers. David Leventhal, communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics.
And now let's get another takeout from Vancouver and the Winter Olympics. Jason Stallman is covering it for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
Okay, so for the Olympics today, let's start with Lindsey Vonn, already a gold medalist from this Winter Olympics, but she could possibly get another one in an event today.
Lindsey's skiing an event today. You know, she's had a few days off, so she's kind of like drifted out of everyone's attention for a little bit, and she's back in the giant slalom. This is not an event that she's been particularly strong in. In fact, her teammate, Julia Mancuso, who also has a couple medals here in Vancouver, she's a little bit better at this event than Vonn is. So the Americans could come away with a medal, but don't be surprised if it's not Lindsey Vonn.
Okay, but the big news, at least for me, but I'm sure for lots and lots of people, are the hockey quarterfinals. And this is exciting on both the men's side and on the women's side. What's going on?
Well, on the men's side, you have what many people would have called a gold medal game coming into the Olympics. It was pretty well understood that Canada and Russia were fielding the best teams, and they were expected to ultimately meet for the gold medal. Canada had some troubles in their early round, so now they're having to face Russia in the quarterfinals after beating Germany today. So that's going to be a big showdown. You know, when Canada played the United States on Sunday, that was the highest-rated sporting event in television history in Canada. They said that 2 out of 3 Canadians were watching that game, and I have to believe at least that many are going to be watching Canada-Russia today.
The exciting thing for me as we start getting closer in is that, you know, there's a chance that both the women and the men's U.S. teams could be vying for a gold in hockey.
This is true. On the women's side, Canada and the United States clearly are far superior than the rest of the competition. So they're in the semifinals now playing different opponents, and they'll almost certainly meet in the finals, and one of them is going to come away with a gold medal.
It's very exciting. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times.
And now on to Washington and the Supreme Court. You have a right to remain silent. You have a right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed to you. I'm trying to quote the Miranda warning that we're all familiar with. Now, it turns out that you don't have to do it exactly. After a 7-2 decision at the Supreme Court yesterday, apparently police can now ad-lib Miranda rights.
You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to a court-appointed attorney. You have the right to sing the blues. You have the right to cable TV. That's very important. You have the right to sublet. You have the right to paint the walls. No loud colors.
All right, they may not want to get that far afield, but here to explain the Supreme Court decision and the reasoning behind it is Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Now, Adam, maybe not the right to paint the walls and sing the blues, but what was the court saying yesterday?
The court says that the Miranda warnings are really principles. It's not a form that is written out in the Constitution, but a series of principles. And so long as the police give you those principles, those ideas well enough, the Supreme Court's not going to give you a form, a card that you actually have to read from. The question in the case whether police in Tampa, and they had a little form of their own, got it right when they did say two things. They said, you have the right to talk to a lawyer before answering any of our questions. That's fine. But then they didn't go on to say you have a right to have a lawyer with you when we ask you questions, or that you have a right to ask for a lawyer once we start asking questions. The Supreme Court said that was close enough because at the end of the warning there was this kind of little catch-all phrase, you have the right to use any of these rights at any time during the interview, and they thought that criminals are smart enough to say that must mean I have a right to a lawyer with me at the interview.
All right. Well, we had the comedy Police Academy 2 at the top, which is obviously not the real world. But in the real world, Adam Liptak from the New York Times, it seems that if it's just principles officers have to impart, that they may be opening themselves up to many more legal challenges because principles are so murky. Aren't we going to see a lot more cases now about principles of Miranda?
Cops will probably still be safer if they either go back to the original Miranda decision and more or less use the language in there, or interestingly, the Supreme Court said that you can do it better than Miranda. It said the FBI does it the best of all, and the FBI actually has some very plain English language. It says, and this doesn't sound like the Miranda warnings, but it sounds pretty good, you have the right to talk to a lawyer for advice before we ask you any questions. You have the right to have a lawyer with you during questioning. Now, that's plain English. It doesn't sound like what you hear on the cop shows. It actually sounds a little bit better. The Supreme Court's point is it's not going to micromanage how cops do it, but it wants at least the concepts to be put across. And I guess the other thing I'd say is that people have seen this on TV enough times that it doesn't really matter how you tell it to them because they've already heard it.
They've already heard it, and they may already know their rights, or at least we hope they do, but police still have to inform you of your rights. It's your constitutional right. Adam Liptak of the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, thanks for joining us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John. He'll be back tomorrow. Well, coming up, our series Frustration Nation continues. Is the media to blame for congressional gridlock? We've got lots of reactions from you, and we take a closer look in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top stories at 31 minutes after the hour. Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, will address lawmakers on Capitol Hill later this morning. Toyoda, who is the grandson of the company's founder, is expected to apologize for safety lapses, and he will possibly say the company might have grown too far too fast. Yesterday, the company's U.S. president, James Lentz, told Congress he's not sure Toyota has fixed the sudden acceleration problems.
It's taken us too long to come to grips with a rare but serious set of safety issues, despite all of our good faith efforts.
There should be more on the acceleration problem formed from Toyota's boss later today. A quick update now on the health of the former vice president, Dick Cheney. Doctors say he did have a mild heart attack on Monday, but he's feeling better now. He's expected to leave a Washington hospital in the next few days.
Executives from health insurance giant Anthem Blue Cross tell California lawmakers their premium hikes are fair and legal, and they say increases will likely happen. Today, a House committee will question executives from Anthem's parent company, WellPoint, on the planned rate spikes of up to 39%. Major League Baseball says it will implement blood testing for human growth hormone in the minor leagues this year. The players' union had resisted blood testing, but it's the only way to find HGH, which helps build muscles and allows for quicker recovery from injury. And a new study says doctors are cutting back on their hours. The report says doctors went from averaging 55 hours a week to 51 hours over the past decade. That's the equivalent of losing 36,000 doctors nationwide. Study author Douglas Steger says there's a reason for the drop.
Lower fees and increased market pressure on physicians, we think, may have contributed to the decline.
In the past 10 years, he says there's been a 25% decline in doctors' pay. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are down. European indices are mixed. Futures are up, though. The Dow will get underway at 10,292. The S&P starts at 1,094 and the NASDAQ at 2,213. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry, and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business,
is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
All this week, we've been having conversations about gridlock in Washington. It's a series we're calling Frustration Nation. Yesterday, we talked about the role of the media and whether we in the media perpetuate the political divisiveness and the dysfunction in Washington and across the country overall. Well, so many of you have written in and called at 877-8-MY-TAKE about this topic that we've decided to take a few of your reactions and put them to the editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. That's Mike Hoyt. So, Mike, let's explore now why so many Americans have grown angry with political news coverage. I want to start with Isaac, a strong example of the fervent anger that we heard from yesterday.
This is Isaac calling from Riverdale, New York. The media is responsible for having put us through the Iraq War, the second one, and it's because of the media that we're in the economic situation that we're in right now because of their faulty coverage of Wall Street.
Now, Mike Hoyt, Isaac may be frustrated for a media that's done too little, I guess, from Iraq and preventing the Wall Street collapse. Are a lot of Americans, do you think, as angry as Isaac when it comes to media coverage of the government?
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I think there's a lot of free-floating anger out there, and a lot of it's landing on the media, and I think some of it's legitimate and some of it isn't. I mean, the press didn't start the war in Iraq. You know, the Bush administration started that, and the press didn't ruin the economy. We have some other institutions to blame for that. Some people like to blame the press for not reflecting the world they want or for reflecting a world that they don't like, the way things are going. But, you know, that said, I mean, those two issues that Isaac raised, the war and the economy are tests that the mainstream media did fail, I think. When the rationale for the war was being put forward, I don't think the press, it's a lot of people don't think that the press put enough pressure on the arguments, especially the WMD argument, and just sort of was credulous and let that argument go forward without a test. I don't know if they could have stopped the war, but they sure could have challenged its rationale.
That was the issue of weapons of mass destruction, and the economy is complex. Iraq was complex, and another issue that's complex, of course, that's in front right now is healthcare. Yesterday, we had on Kathleen Hall Jamison from the Annenberg Public Policy Center, Mike Hoyt, and here's one point she made about how headline-driven news is changing the way Americans get their news.
The media are able to digest complex issues in short segments if they want to. A Republican plan, you'll be able to buy insurance across state lines. Democratic plan, you'll be able to carry your insurance until you're 26 if you're a student. The complexities of plans can be reduced to short segments.
It doesn't mean you can't get confused. Now, Anne from Massachusetts wrote on our website, thetakeaway.org, we depend on the media to call politicians out for misstatements and lies. The healthcare reform debate is an example. We hear that most Americans are happy with insurance. Then we hear that 30 million people are without insurance. Please clarify what this means. Kathleen Hall Jamison is saying even when things are complex, they can be made understandable even in soundbite form, and that sometimes the media does succeed in doing it, Mike Hoyt.
Well, I mean, they're both right. I mean, the changes of the digital revolution are, you know, they're just so profound we don't even know can't even get our arms around them. But one of them is that there's just so much more information and so much more noise out there that everyone is trying to break through. There's just simply more competition, and one way to break through is to sort of outshout or out-hype or out-pander or out-simplify the other person. But that's not the only way. I actually believe in competition. I think it's a good thing, and I think the media is in competition with everything now, not just other media, but everything for attention. And another way to break through is to clarify and to add depth and to have sharp angles and analysis.
Now, here's another listener who's upset with what she's been hearing and reading. When we think about the political situation we're in today, is the media trying to turn around too much, too fast, and missing the small stories that really actually make a difference in people's lives and in public opinion?
This is Marcia from the Boston area. I hold the media very responsible, not for creating problems, but for making them go on and for making them worse. The media should be reading the healthcare plan and reporting what it says. the media should be investigating when the Republicans or Democrats make claims against each other that aren't truthful and reporting on the truth.
Now, a couple of listeners complained about the political opinions they hear from their news sources. Assad from Fort Lauderdale writes, the media is at fault for the most persuasive part of the situation, public opinion. Most people get their news from TV and radio, which also shapes their opinions on the issues. And when the media highlights the debate in an exaggerated manner, the end result is that public opinion starts to take on this exaggerated view. And Neil from Columbia, South Carolina wrote on the website, the media has to take some of the blame for this. There is almost no distinction between opinion and hard news. Pundits become experts, and people with real expertise are rarely featured. And to this mix, the drive for ratings and pandering journalism is now the norm. So as we go through all these comments, it seems that listeners overall are frustrated with the media, and that's why we're covering it on The Takeaway, because there are complex issues out there. Healthcare is a prime example. We've seen so much frustration, especially among supporters of the healthcare bill, frankly, that as popular as parts of this bill are, as Celeste said earlier, the bill overall is not popular.
But I think that what we can do as journalists is to be transparent about how we choose sources, because you should be choosing reputable, credible sources and not just pundits or bloggers who have an opinion. Everyone has an opinion. And we should be holding people to task if they say something that is incorrect. We should be fact-checking the people who are on the show, absolutely.
Fact-checking is the first principle of this industry. We hope we're doing it right here on The Takeaway, and we hope that you think so too. Mike Hoyt is editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, who joined us, and you, the listener, joined us. Thanks to you all.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The president of the Japanese car automaker Toyota is about to appear before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee today. As Congress looks into Toyota's recall of millions of vehicles, they're talking about sudden acceleration problems that have been blamed for about 30 U.S. deaths. The most high-profile appearance is going to come today when Akio Toyota appears before Congress. He's the president of the largest company in Japan. But how is this being reported, the recalls, Akio Toyota's appearance? How is it going over in Japan? To answer that, we have Michael Chuchek. He's an American blogger and a research analyst who's lived in Japan for more than 15 years, and he joins us now from Tokyo. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So you have some papers in front of you?
Yes, I have the copy of all of these morning's papers, yeah.
And what are the headlines as Akio Toyota heads to Congress today?
Well, it depends. If you're on the right, on the conformist conservative side of the political spectrum, there's a great deal of concern about what this all means for the U.S.-Japan security relationship. So these conservative newspapers are tending to play up a sense of concern or even fear about a deterioration of that relationship. On the other hand, the business press, quite interestingly, is rather sanguine about the whole affair. National Business Daily, the Nihon Keizai Shimbun, didn't have the story as its top story this morning. So they seem to take the attitude that recalls and defects are just part of doing business.
What has been kind of the attitude among in coverage and among the Japanese people about this whole recall in the United States? Do they feel the U.S. is blowing it out of proportion? Do they feel Toyota is unfairly targeted?
That's a really touchy thing to say because you don't want to appear to be reacting to the United States' actions. But nevertheless, there is a sense that Mr. Toyota today is walking into a lion's den at the U.S. Congress, and that the best he can hope for is to not get too badly mauled. The nation's papers, all the business ones, have all said that this is not really so much a hearing as a political show. Seiji no show is the term they use, and that this is an election year in the United States, and that Congress's men and women are going to try to make a good impression on television for their constituents.
I've heard it said by several people that public apologies have a very different tenor to them in Japan than they do in the United States. Many of Toyota's executives have been apologizing publicly, and Akio Toyota is expected to do that today. How is that seen in Japan?
Well, the apology is always expected. The only difference is that in this case, there is no consumer, or there was no consumer protection agency in Japan until very recently. And as a consequence, there isn't a familiarity with dealing with consumers very, very hopped up and with the government behind them. Basically, the companies have been facing the consumers by themselves, and it's an unfair fight.
Okay, that is Michael Chuchek. He's the author of the Shishaku blog on Japanese politics and society. He joins us from Tokyo, taking a look at the headlines. Kind of interesting that the business papers in Japan aren't carrying that as the top headline.
I found that shocking.
I mean, Toyota is the largest company in Japan. And it's interesting, however, Akio Toyota appearing before Congress today.
The conversation continues at thetakeaway.org. Leave a comment now. You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick. He's filling in for John Hockenberry until John returns tomorrow. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about healthcare. We talked to two congressmen from both sides of the aisle earlier. We have a couple, two or three Americans who listened in the conversation, and they're going to give us what they heard from the congressman in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a shortcut to get the health care bill passed. The fast-track approach, known as reconciliation, would allow Democrats to bypass Republican opposition and pass the bill with just 51 votes. But GOP Senator Mitch McConnell says his party still opposes the bill.
And I would say putting a new name on a whole lot more spending is clearly not reform.
A new survey by the Pew Research Center suggests Democrats are losing some support among 18 to 29-year-olds. The study says only 54% of young voters now identify as Democrat. That's down 8% from 2008. Former Vice President Dick Cheney suffered a mild heart attack on Monday. An aide says Cheney is feeling fine now and will likely be sent home from a Washington hospital within a day or two.
After a long ban, the Pentagon may allow women to serve on Navy submarines. The subs were off limits to women because of concerns over how to manage men and women working together in such close quarters. Moving to Afghanistan now, the U.S. military plans to spend more than $600 million to build nearly 200 police stations for Afghan police in the coming year. The Communist Party in China, meanwhile, has issued a new ethics code to try to stamp out corruption among officials. The code bans property speculation, money-making deals, and extravagant weddings and funerals. BBC correspondent in Beijing says the authorities are struggling to deal with academic corruption. Finally, in Haiti, the last two American missionaries being held on child kidnapping charges may be freed very soon. One of them is Laura Silsby.
We are thanking God for the judge's efforts to seek out truth, which will confirm our innocence of all charges.
The other eight missionaries in the group were released this last week. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, President Obama will hold a bipartisan summit tomorrow about health care. Both House and Senate leaders will be there. Earlier this hour, we spoke with two lawmakers from the House who also happen to be physicians, Jim McDermott, a Democrat from Washington State, and Michael Burgess, a Republican from Texas. And we wanted to bring this discussion back full circle from the lawmakers in Washington back to the public that they serve. We have three friends of The Takeaway with us. Rashonda Young, joined us last summer for one of our healthcare roundtable discussions. She's the operations manager of Alpha Express. That's a small business in Waterloo, Iowa. Steve Rose, Takeaway listener from Detroit. He called in to actually comment on the healthcare debate, and we liked what he had to say. And Dr. Peter Sinton, he commented on our website about the cost of healthcare. He's a pediatrician and co-owns a practice in Ponco, Oklahoma. Good morning to all three of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Steve, I wanted to start with you, and I wanted to play for you a comment that Congressman Burgess made. He serves the 26th District of Texas. He was talking about things that he would support in terms of insurance reform, and one way he thought was by sending it back to the states. Here's what he had to say.
We could start tomorrow on just essentially insurance reform to begin to get around the problem of pre-existing conditions. You do that by risk pools, you do that by reinsurance. 34 states already have programs set up. Perhaps we're not funding them appropriately. Maybe that is one direction we could go.
A restriction, I mean, keeping people from losing insurance or not being able to get insurance because of a pre-existing condition has broad public support. Do you support a not having pre-existing condition restrictions? Steve?
Do I support not having?
In other words, do you think people should be barred from insurance for having because of a pre-existing condition, or should we bar insurance companies from doing that?
No, I think that's a reasonable I guess, requirement, especially going forward, if this plan is going to go forward. I don't think it's unreasonable. I think there has to be some protections for insurance providers, and we can't just unload every cost that they might incur without giving it some thoughtful consideration and review.
Okay, you just heard Michael Burgess saying that there's certain programs already in place in many states that address some insurance problems. Do you think that the states already have some of these answers?
Well, I think if 34 states, what's that, two-thirds of the country already have something in place, they must be onto something. And the people in Washington who think that the government knows best, that the federal government knows better than the states, maybe they should take a look at what the states are doing.
Okay, Roshana Young, let me go to you. You're the operations manager of a small business, and you've had trouble being able to afford health care for your employees.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, when you initially turn in your applications and you get your initial quote, you get rates that are reasonable. Then they look at the health of each person on the plan, and they start excluding, you know, pre-existing conditions, and they, you know, double what you were initially quoted. It's not reasonable or affordable for small businesses.
Can you give me an idea of what some of these premiums cost for your business, for an employee?
For example, for an individual plan, initial quotes, you know, coming back at $241, that's not bad. But once you get health questionnaires in, an individual will cost you over $400 a month. A family, which is initially quoted at $500 and some, is almost $1,000 a month. That's a lot of money for a small business to be able to afford.
Okay, both of the congressmen addressed this issue of rate hikes and the cost of premiums. Did you hear something that you liked?
In terms of the rate hikes, definitely I believe that having a federal overseer so that the rate hikes can only go up, you know, at a reasonable percentage is definitely a must. The insurance companies have not been fair. They've had plenty of time to prove, you know, whether or not they can do this on their own, and they haven't proven that they can.
Okay, now let's go to you, Peter Sinton. You're a pediatrician in rural Oklahoma. Both of the congressmen we spoke to were also doctors. You have 80% of your patients qualify for Medicaid. What about the other 20%?
The other 20% typically have some type of private insurance, and then a small percent are self-pay or cash pay. But because of the whole rate hikes of the change in the structure of how people are insured now, the people that are supposedly insured with private insurance actually have very high deductibles and therefore are basically self-pay. And, you know, as the two congressmen know, if they were practicing physicians, that, you know, when you have self-pay patients, you rely on you know, you're kind of caught between being an altruistic physician and being a business person, which I don't like being a business person.
Okay. Did you hear something from the congressman? We heard from someone from Texas, Michael Burgess, and also the congressman from Washington State, a Democrat. Did you hear anything that gave you faith that they understand what's really at issue here and that we could get some bipartisan cooperation during the summit tomorrow?
I don't think there's going to be cooperation. I think some of the core issues of insurance reform and affecting, you know, how we get premiums down is really distasteful to the Republicans. I think they want the market system to correct this. They want competition. You know, I remember McCain talking about during the election, talking about let's get competition between states, and that's a fair thing to suggest. The other thing I think they've suggested is cooperatives, which costs an enormous amount of capital, and if you get, you know, just a group of people together, I mean, you know, they're not coming up with the kind of capital to support a non-for-profit cooperative of health coverage. So I think we're rather stuck with insurance companies because they have the basis, the capital to fund, you know, sick patients and well patients, like they said, patients with pre-existing conditions.
Okay, let me ask you, Dr. Peter Sinton, a pediatrician from Oklahoma, yes or no, have you written your congressman or senator about this?
Oh, yeah. I've emailed.
Roshana Young in Iowa, have you written your congressman or senator?
I sure have.
Okay, Steve Rose from Detroit, are you still there?
Yes.
Have you written your congressman or senator about this?
Yes, I have.
Okay, three people who've all spoken to their congresspeople but don't seem to have a lot of faith that we're going to get cooperation or reform moving in Washington. That was Steve Rose, a listener from Detroit. Rashonda Young is the operations manager of a family-run business in Waterloo, Iowa. And Dr. Peter Sinton, pediatrician from Ponca City, Oklahoma. Thanks to all three of you.
You can catch up on all our health care coverage or anything else you missed by going to the site, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, we have another bonus from our staff. A lot of news outlets have reported the 1,000th American casualty in Afghanistan, but it turns out that the actual total is both lower and harder to pin down. Producer Noel King looked at just how we get the number wrong and how we get to the number of 1,000. That's on thetakeaway.org and click on blog. And as always, we want your suggestions for who had a good week and a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. The 8778-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org is the place to give us your suggestions. I'm Todd Zwilligan for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.